From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the search for the origins of the universe. We talk with astrophysicist George Smoot. In 1992, he and his team of scientists shocked the world with their announcement that they'd detected cosmic radiation patterns that gave credence to the Big Bang theory. It was described by Stephen Hawking as the scientific discovery of the century, if not all time. Also today, singer, songwriter, musician, and record producer Ben Vaughn is back with his new recording, Mono USA, featuring his versions of some favorite but obscure recordings from the 60s. We'll compare his versions with the originals. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Monty, the new Fox sitcom starring Henry Winkler. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says Ukraine will give up the nuclear arsenal it inherited from the former Soviet Union. Mr. Clinton says he, Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk, and Russian President Boris Yeltsin will sign an agreement on the nuclear dismantlement this week in Moscow. The president calls the agreement a historic breakthrough. Mr. Clinton is in Brussels, Belgium, for a two-day NATO summit. The Allies have accepted a Clinton proposal to extend limited partnership to former Soviet satellites. It's called the Partnership for Peace Initiative. New members won't be full members, and they won't get the same security guarantees as they would if they were full NATO members. They will get to participate in military exercises and peacekeeping missions, but they'll also have to accept some guidelines on democracy and human rights. NATO leaders are also struggling with a European war. They are trying to decide what to do about the Bosnian conflict. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Brussels.
The U.S. came to Brussels hoping that Bosnia would not overshadow the NATO meeting, but France has succeeded in elevating the issue of the tragedy in the former Yugoslavia. France had wanted the U.S. to give explicit support to a peace plan now being considered by the warring factions to agree to send U.S. peacekeepers to join the French and British contingents on the ground, and it wanted NATO to reassert its intention to help implement the peace plan should it be accepted. Instead, the NATO members issued a statement reaffirming their readiness to carry out airstrikes under UN authorization should the strangulation of Sarajevo continue, but they made no move to call for airstrikes. President Clinton issued a stern warning to the Europeans today. He said, if we are going to reassert this warning, we have to mean it. In Brussels, I'm Mara Liasson.
Cool, wet weather in Australia has helped to bring brush fires under control. But firefighters are still on alert because forecasters are warning that hot, windy weather will return. John Radler reports from Sydney.
There were no new outbreaks today, and most of the fires in and around Sydney, while far from extinguished, are contained. The day-long respite resulted from a change in the weather. A little rain, cool temperatures, and high humidity helped bring the fires under control. But more hot, windy weather is predicted, and authorities warn the big blazes of recent days could reignite. Firefighters relished a more relaxed workday today. For some of them, their first letdown in more than a week. One firefighter, killed when a burning tree fell on him last week, was buried today. He was one of four fatalities to date. For National Public Radio, I'm John Radler in Sydney.
Stock prices soared to their fourth straight record close today. The Dow Industrials gained nearly 45 points to end at 3,865.51. This is NPR. Israel and the PLO have resumed peace talks today in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Taba. Negotiators are trying to clear obstacles in the way of Israeli troop withdrawal from Gaza and the West Bank town of Jericho. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israelis and Palestinians have different estimates of how long it should take to reach an agreement and for Israel to begin its withdrawal from the Gaza Strip in the West Bank town of Jericho. Palestinian negotiator Nabil Shat says he predicts about 3 weeks, while Israeli cabinet minister Yossi Sarid says it could take up to 8 weeks. The issues are the same they have been since the agreement was signed in September: control over borders, the size of Jericho, and security for Jewish settlers. The withdrawal was supposed to begin almost a month ago, but disagreements on these issues held up the implementation. Meanwhile, the economic situation in the territories is growing worse because donor countries have not transferred money to the PLO. Palestinians say that the delay and the economic difficulties are causing a drop in support for the agreement. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Dozens of potential jurors in the Branch Davidian trial are being questioned today in San Antonio, Texas. 11 former cult members are charged with murdering 4 federal agents at their compound near Waco. At least 6 cult members are thought to have died in the ensuing firefight. The incident ended 51 days later when the compound burned to the ground, killing almost everyone who remained inside. The Coast Guard and private workers are continuing to clean up an oil spill that happened off Puerto Rico last week. The Coast Guard says 750,000 gallons of oil poured from a tanker off San Juan on Friday. The ship was carrying 1.5 million gallons of oil. About 100,000 gallons have been recovered. Thick and sticky oil is washing up on 6 miles of San Juan Beach, which is lined with hotels and tourist spots. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How and why did the universe begin, and what is our place in it? Those are some pretty big questions. Answering them is what George Smoot's work is all about. Smoot is a cosmologist. He studies the science of the universe. And in 1992, a team of scientists he led made a discovery so important it's been called the Holy Grail of cosmology. Smoot's team found evidence of the Big Bang. The Big Bang theory says that the universe was created when a particle smaller than an atom exploded and kept expanding and expanding. If the Big Bang theory is true, there would have to be cosmic radiation patterns left over from the explosion. No one could find those patterns until Smoot measured them in 1992. Along the way, Smoot had many adventures, sending his telescopes and spy planes and giant helium balloons and taking them to the South Pole. Smoot has written a new book about his work called Wrinkles in Time. Let's start with an explanation of the Big Bang theory.
It's the idea that the universe isn't always been the same as it is now, but in fact it's been expanding and evolving, that as you go backwards in time, the universe was smaller, things were closer together, it was more dense, it was hotter, and it's more energetic, and that the universe started from an incredibly hot and sort of dense state, and it's been expanding and cooling ever since. As it expands and cools, it is able to build up complicated structures like stars and galaxies and life as we know it. And so in a very simple viewpoint, the Big Bang is just the fact that we live in an expanding and evolving universe.
The Big Bang, if I understand it correctly, says basically that the whole universe came out of a little subatomic particle that exploded and expanded. I find that just impossible to fathom.
Right. When we go and look more carefully and think about what it means for the universe, if we extrapolate back to the very beginning, we can say everything that we can see, and we think we can see out 15 billion light years in any direction. Those are tremendously huge distances. Everything we can see was once in a place that's such smaller than any particle we know of, smaller than a proton, very subatomic size. And the universe expanded. And what happened is something that's hard to conceive and hard to think of. But what actually happened is not only did the universe, was it hotter and denser then, but there was less space and less material. And as the universe sort of exploded, what it exploded was it made more space, it made more time, and it made more material. But from a tiny fraction after the beginning, everything that we can see was actually in a region that was extremely small. But a tiny fraction of a second is less than the time it takes light to go across the room.
What kind of evidence do we have that the world started from a subatomic particle, which exploded and then expanded to create what is now known as the universe?
All right, well, one of the biggest things that we know is we know the universe is expanding. And this is something that we've known since the late 1920s when the American astronomer Edwin Hubble went out and first showed that these things that were called nebula, that would just look like groups of stars, that a big fraction of them were from outside of our own galaxy. And one of the things that he determined, particularly with the help of his assistant Humason, was that the galaxies seem to be moving apart, that if we look at them, the further away they are, the faster they seem to be moving away from us. And this is what you'd expect in the giant explosion, the giant expansion of the universe. The further away things are, the faster they're moving. And so that's sort of how we came into the name of the Big Bang, the idea that the galaxies were all moving apart. And it's a little bit of misconceptions because a lot of people thought, well, there was this giant explosion and the things that were going fastest went furthest. If you give everybody the same time, you have a big explosion and you go for an hour, the people that are moving 30 miles an hour get 30 miles and the people that are going 60 miles an hour get 60 miles. And so you make a snapshot, the people are going twice as fast or twice as far away. And so that immediately implanted in people's mind the idea of a giant explosion. But the idea we have now is that it's the space itself that's expanding. And so the analogy that people usually give is a balloon, and you put dots on a balloon, and as the balloon expands, the dots move further apart. And the ones that are farthest apart are moving apart fastest just because of the overall expansion. Now, the idea that the universe is expanding is naturally starts to tell you that the universe is changing with time, and if you extrapolate backwards, it should get more dense.
You found what's considered to be a relic of the Big Bang explosion. It's something from the afterglow of the Big Bang. Where does your discovery fit in?
Well, what we discovered was equivalent to making a picture of the universe when it's very young. Using the light that came from the hot early phase of the universe, we've looked at that light. It's traveled to us sort of unchanged since the very early times. And we've gone out and used our instruments and made a map. And this map is what I call a baby photo of the universe. It's a picture of what the universe looks like when it's 300,000 years old. Now, 300,000 years seems like a long time, but if you take the present universe and think of it as a middle-aged person, that's equivalent to a picture of a human being when it's 5 hours after conception.
So you have this equivalent of like a baby photo of the universe. What did you find looking at that information that revealed something new?
Once we got this baby photo of the universe, the first thing that impressed us was how uniform it was, that when you look at this picture, the first thing you notice is it's all the same. No matter where you look in the universe, it looked the same. And you have to go down in excruciating detail in order to see any variations. And that's why it took years of observations and analysis in order to get here. And what we found was that there are tiny variations that are parts in a million to parts in 100,000, variations that show that the universe wasn't exactly a uniform suit to begin with, but there were these tiny variations where there was slightly more matter and energy over here and slightly less there. And those are the variations that are going to turn into the things that we think are interested in the universe. A place where there was slightly more material, by its gravitational attraction, pulled in the material around it. That pulled in even more material until you got this huge aggregation. Sometimes it would turn out to be a galaxy, sometimes clusters of galaxies, sometimes clusters of galaxies, sometimes even larger scale structure. And our evidence is there will be even larger things that are forming that haven't had time to form now. Bigger things take longer time to form. And this is an exciting thing because it tells us how we got from a very nearly uniform early universe to the present day structures where we see the galaxies, the clusters of galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and the larger scale structure.
So let me see if I understand this. You've taken, by measuring light generated zillions of years ago, you've taken a baby photograph of the universe back when the universe was really dense, before it had expanded like it has now. And you found that even though the universe was really dense, there were variations, and you've interpreted that as being a sign that at the very, very start of the universe, there were variations that eventually grew into the great variations that we have now.
So we have a picture of the universe when it was very young, 1,000 times smaller than it is now. And what we see there are what we call the primordial seeds, the seeds that are going to grow into the interesting structure we see today, mm-hmm. all the things that make life possible and make the beautiful pictures of the night sky. But we also can tell, because of some of the things we see are so large, that they had to be present right from the very beginning. They had to be what I would call the birthmarks of the universe. They are the very process of creating space and time and all the matter in it created these small variations. The process that created it was nearly perfect process. I mean, to a part in 100,000, it made the same universe everywhere we look almost perfectly. But the very small machining marks, or whatever you want to call them, the process of making time and space, makes these small fluctuations and makes the universe interesting and exciting.
Your discovery has been called the Holy Grail of cosmology. What are the implications of what you found?
This gets a little more subtle. I mean, one of the problems that the Big Bang was facing was that all the previous measurements before our COBE satellite measurement, we had seen only upper limits. We'd seen the universe was smoother and smoother. And so we were wondering, how can the very early smooth universe evolve into the complicated universe we see today? And so for a lot of cosmologists, that, you know, that was the big thing that we saw, finally a way to explain how structure formed the universe. But for the people who were worried about how the universe actually began, how was space and time formed, how was all the matter generated inside of it, this also provides an interesting clue. So we link the beginning of the universe to the very early stages of the universe until the present-day universe. And the fact that we see structure on all scales, just exactly the kind of structure we see today, in fact, structure that hasn't even formed yet, the fact that we see them so early tells us that structure was imprinted right in the time of creation, the creation of time and space and all the matter in it. That was imprinted right at that time. And that tells you something about how the creation occurred, how everything was made. And so that's why it's so exciting for a lot of people, particularly people worried about explaining the grand sweep of how do we come into being and how do we get to where we are today. This is a sort of a keystone that puts everything together and gives us an idea that we're not only on the right track, but that we have hope of learning what happened the first tiny fraction of a second in the creation of the universe.
If you're just joining us, my guest is cosmologist George Smoot, and he was the principal investigator of the team that discovered evidence of the primeval explosion that started the universe known as the Big Bang. That was back in 1992. His book about the discovery and about the Big Bang theory is called Wrinkles in Time. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is cosmologist George Smoot. When you and your team made your discovery, you were afraid that the calculations weren't accurate. So you made an offer to the people working with you. What was your offer?
What happened is, as we were making the discovery, what I was afraid was people would get out of the habit of checking to see that we were doing things right and making sure the data were coming in correctly and we were processing correctly and we'd done everything right, and get excited about the results. And so I made an offer. Anyone who could find a mistake that would explain what our results were in terms of us having done something wrong or something funny with the instrument, that they would get a free trip anywhere in the world that they wanted to go. And that was to show everybody we were serious, because what's really important, we're looking for extremely small variations here, this part in a million, parts in 100,000. It's very easy to make a mistake and see something like that, because everything that we're seeing is what happened at the very beginning of the universe. That means anything that happened since then could interfere with our measurements, including our own mistakes. And so it's very important for the group to work together as a team and to be really careful checking over what they did before we ran off and said, we've discovered something exciting, and then, whoops, it's a mistake. We put a 5 instead of a 4 in the computer, and then we got the wrong answer.
So you wanted to make the person who found a mistake into a hero, as opposed to them being a spoilsport who everybody would hate for ruining this great theory?
Absolutely. You have to give people encouragement to come and do the right thing, because everybody gets excited with the result. Nobody wants to be the one that say, oh, everybody made a mistake, we go back, everybody become depressed. No, you want them to be a hero, that they really did their job properly.
Mm-hmm. But of course nobody found a mistake. There didn't seem to be any mistakes.
Right. Well, no one found a mistake at a large area. There's plenty of small things. We know all kinds of corrections at the 5 and 10% level, but no one found a mistake that could explain everything we saw.
Let's talk about what you had to do in order to make your discovery. First of all, you put microwave telescopes onto U-2 planes. Now, the U-2s were spy planes. Were they still spy planes when you had access to them?
The ones we had access to were at NASA Ames, which is in the South Bay of San Francisco, which made them convenient for us. And before that time, I'd been flying things on balloons, and balloons have this unfortunate quality that when they come down, they're not very controlled, and often your equipment is ruined. And then we found out about the U-2 and thought, this is a great thing. We want to do this experiment over and over and calibrate it, and here's a way to have controlled situation where we can get the equipment back and check it each time, and then fly it again in a new environment. And so the U-2 was actually still being used as a spy plane in certain parts of the world at that time, but it was no longer making flights over what's now the former Soviet Union. But there was still a lot of pride and secrecy involved in the U-2, And it was sort of a thrill for us to get to fly on it because it's such a beautiful plane and because there was this mystique about it.
So before you used the U-2, you sent up helium balloons with your telescope. Describe what a helium balloon is like for something complicated like this. It's not just a regular old helium balloon. It's not like in the Wizard of Oz.
Well, it somehow looks like it looks a little bit like the hot air balloons, only it's much, much larger. We're talking about balloons that hold millions of cubic feet of helium when they're fully inflated. And when they get up to full altitude, they make this sort of spherical shape, and you can see the sun glinting off them. They look like a planet. But if they were on the ground, they would fill up a football stadium. We're talking about really huge things. But they're actually made very flimsily. They're made out of things that are like dry cleaner bag plastic. It's very thin plastic. And so you have to be very careful with them on the ground and have low winds and make sure there's no stresses on them. And so it's sort of this romantic thing like hot air ballooning, only you have to, it's bigger and you have to be more careful. And as you let it go up, you think it's going to be this quiet, eerie thing, but there's all this rustling and shaking around of the plastic as it's expanding and shifting and carrying under the weight. And then it sort of lofts off into the evening and the setting sun, and you take data all through the night. And then you have to worry that you keep track of where the balloon is so that when the daylight comes and you want to send it to the ground and recover it, you can actually see it and find it and hope that it doesn't fall on something that's pretty terrible. And often it does fall onto a mountainside or a tree or someplace that damaged the equipment. You have to start all over again.
Now, you went to Antarctica with your observation equipment. Why is Antarctica a particularly good place to observe what you were looking for?
One of the problems you have when you're observing on the Earth is the Earth itself is very warm. We're used to living in a nice environment. The Earth's temperature is about 300 degrees above absolute zero, whereas the radiation we're looking at is only 3 degrees. But we also have this warm blanket of atmosphere, which today you might not feel that way because of the snow, but it's really warm compared to the coldness of space. And we have to look away from the Earth and look through this atmosphere, and they present big signals compared to the universe as a whole. And so you want to go to high altitude so you can get above the atmosphere and as far from the Earth as you can and shield yourself from the Earth. Well, it turns out Antarctica has a tremendous amount of ice on it. And when we went to the South Pole, we found out that the South Pole has almost 2 miles of ice on it. So you're 2 miles up, so it's like being on top of a mountain. But the nice thing about it is it's extremely flat because it's ice and it's water and the wind is blowing. The South Pole is, in some sense, extremely boring because you get out and look away from the station. All you see is this flat ground stretching as far as you can see it going over the horizon. And the only features of interest are these little things called sastrugi, which are about an inch high, little ripples in the ice where the wind has caught a little bit of ice and made a little bit of a snowdrift. And so it's very flat. It's very high. And the atmosphere is very cold. And that freezes out all the water. That's where the ice comes from. And the water is the main variable part of the atmosphere. You know, when you look at the sky, you sometimes see clouds, and the clouds vary around. The oxygen and the other things are pretty much stable. So if you want to make a map of what the sky looks like, clouds get in your way. So if you can find a place where the water is all frozen out, like the South Pole, then it's a good place. And the other thing that happened is, man, it's becoming more and more technological, like the radio and television. There's a lot more broadcasting, and we try to look at sometimes the long wavelengths or the low frequencies. Almost everywhere in the world now, man is broadcasting. But if you go to the South Pole, if you go a couple kilometers away from the South Pole, there's very little man-made interference there. You only have to worry about satellites. Mm-hmm. And so we could do good observations there.
Are you absolutely convinced that the universe was started by the Big Bang now?
The Big Bang theory is extremely well explained by all the facts that we see. And we see the universe is expanding. We see the relic kinds of atoms and nuclei that are left over from the Big Bang. We see that there were more, that was more dense in the past. We see the relic radiation left over from the hot phase of the Big Bang. We see the structures, the seeds are going to cause everything we see today and give us an indication of how things started. All those things line up and tell us that the Big Bang is really the right theory. The fact that the radiation has so perfect a spectrum, a thermal spectrum, that we went through this hot phase, all those things tell us the Big Bang is really the right theory. And now we're really in the business of trying to determine what caused the Big Bang to start. Where did the universe come from? You know, how did everything work out so beautifully?
Now, how important is your discovery in making the Big Bang theory more conclusive?
Well, it's like it really tells us we're on the right track, and it tells us that we can really learn things about what happened in the first tiny fraction of a second, the very actual beginning of space and time. And let's put it the other way. Suppose we hadn't seen these variations, then we wouldn't think that gravity is what caused things in the universe. And cosmologists believe that gravity not only tells us the shape of space and time, but it holds together all the structures we see in it. And in fact, it was the source of how these structures came into being. If we don't have these variations, if the early universe is perfectly uniform, we need some new mechanism to make the structures we see. That means gravity isn't the dominant force, and therefore we don't know where we're starting from. Without these seeds, then we need to invoke something new, and we have no idea what that would be. And with these seeds and with what they're telling us about the early universe, we're quite confident that the Big Bang is the right way to go and that we could learn more about it and fit the whole picture together very cleanly.
Do you see any parallels between the Big Bang theory of creation and the story of creation as told in the Bible?
I certainly think that there are a lot of different societies have stories of creation that are very similar. Certainly, the Big Bang and the way we see it now, where it's almost creation from nothing, it's creation by letting it be so, is very parallel to the story of Genesis and the Bible. There are other societies that also have stories like that, some that are very different.
Are you a religious person yourself? And I'm asking that like in the sense of if your religion and your scientific discoveries are ever in conflict.
I usually don't come across and tell people what they should believe in terms of religion. I have my own beliefs, I don't find the conflict between science and religion, and I also happen to be fairly interpretive in my views in terms of how I think religion is, that it tells you about what you should do in terms of morality and ethics. And as Galileo said, you know, religion tells you how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And so I have no problem with religion, you know, dealing with that part of people's lives, and science dealing with the physical world. Each one has its own environment, and I think they can coexist quite well.
George Smoot's new book about the Big Bang Theory and his recent discovery is called Wrinkles in Time. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Dave McKenna to play When You Wish Upon a Star.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, recreating the studio recording sound of the 60s in a home basement studio. Musician, songwriter, and record producer Ben Vaughn plays his new recording Mono USA, featuring his versions of some of his favorite but obscure recordings from the 60s. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Monty, the new Fox sitcom that features Henry Winkler as a political conservative with his own talk show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton and other members of NATO have invited former Warsaw Pact countries to join in a new partnership with a military alliance. The Eastern European nations will be allowed to become members of Partnership for Peace. This is President Clinton's plan that will extend the limited NATO membership to the former NATO adversaries. Mr. Clinton has also announced that Ukraine will give up all the Soviet-era long-range nuclear weapons that are still on its soil. Mr. Clinton says up to 1,500 warheads will be dismantled. Ukraine is the third largest nuclear power in the world. President Clinton will sign an agreement to dismantle the weapons this week in Moscow with Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk and Russian President Boris Yeltsin. Fierce battles are being fought around the Bosnian town of Vitez between the mainly Muslim Bosnian army and Bosnian Croats. The Muslims have made gains in battles that have raged all day. We have more from the BBC's Martin Bell in Vitez.
It has again been a bitter battle through the mist and the mud. And whereas after earlier offensives the Muslims were pushed back or withdrew to safer trench lines, this time they have held the most important positions they took. Fighting has been going on all day round the houses they captured north and south of the main road just east of Vitez. As night fell, there was an upsurge of small arms, machine gun and mortar fire. And UN sources confirm that the mainly Muslim Bosnian army has made further gains today from another direction, pushing north from the village of Kruščica. The spearheads of these two attacks are tonight only about a mile apart. The Muslims seem to be trying to link their forces up, thus cutting the entire Croatian enclave in two. The battle is now 2 days old, and the Muslims are reported to be moving up reinforcements, which the Croats cannot do because of their isolation. But the Croats are fighting fiercely for what they hold, and as they see it, their very survival is at stake.
Martin Bell reporting. An outbreak of typhoid fever in Miami has health officials puzzled. From Miami, Doug Phillips reports.
Since the first of these recent typhoid cases was reported in October, 12 of the 13 people afflicted, including a 2-year-old boy, have required hospitalization, and health officials say all are expected to recover. Typhoid fever is a treatable bacterial infection that's rarely fatal. It can be spread through food or water handled by someone carrying the disease. This weekend, officials with Florida's Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services ruled out contaminated water as the source of the typhoid cases and are currently investigating restaurants and eateries in northern Dade County, where all of those infected live. Officials say so far they've not isolated a single place where all 13 bought or consumed food. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 41 points at 3,862. This is NPR. The Supreme Court has let stand a ruling allowing the North American Free Trade Agreement to take effect without a formal statement on likely environmental effects. The court rejected arguments by two citizens groups that said NAFTA will harm air quality in U.S. cities along the Mexican border. The groups also said the trade pact will hurt U.S. laws on recycling, auto emissions, and transportation of hazardous materials. Congress approved NAFTA on December 15th after a fierce political fight. It took effect on New Year's Day. Thousands of homeowners took advantage of some of the lowest interest rates in years and refinanced their homes in 1993. But many may be surprised to find out they can't take an immediate tax deduction for the points paid at closing. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Points are loan origination fees charged by a lender and stated as a percentage of the loan. If they are charged for services such as deed preparation, they are not deductible. If the points were charged for the use of money or what's known as prepaid interest, they are deductible. As a general guideline, the Internal Revenue Service requires points to be deducted over the life of the loan, but they may be written off in the year paid if the loan was used to buy or improve a principal home. The loan must be secured by the home, and the points would have to have been paid directly to the lender. The IRS will not allow a one-year write-off of points in connection with a refinancing that was done solely to take advantage of declining interest rates. IRS Publication 936 clarifies points as a deduction. It also explains how to take a deduction on home mortgage interest. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A published report says the federal government staged radiation research tests in at least 33 veterans' hospitals after World War II. The Boston Herald says the Veterans Affairs Department has found reports of more than 200 experiments done to find out the effects of radiation on the military. It's not clear if the people in the tests knew what was going on or consented. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're going to journey back to the days of mono. My guest Ben Vaughan has produced a new album called Mono USA, featuring his versions of some of his favorite but obscure pop records from the 60s. Vaughan plays all the instruments, does the vocals, and of course produced the sessions in mono. The total cost of the sessions, $140. Vaughan is a songwriter, musician, singer, and record producer. He has several albums under his own name and has also produced albums for the Elektra American Explorer series, including Arthur Alexander's comeback album. Vaughan led the band that accompanied Alexander on his Fresh Air concert. We also recently broadcast a Christmas concert featuring the Ben Vaughan combo. Well, here's the opening track of Vaughan's new album, Mono USA, featuring his cover of Link Wray's Cross Ties. Ben Vaughan, welcome to Fresh Air. You play all the parts through overdubbing on this album. Which part do you play first? What's your approach when you're overdubbing?
I usually lay down drums and then bass. And
why start with the drums?
Just to set the tempo of the tune. It's hard to play drums. Actually, there's drum machine on a lot of this stuff. And I would write the program. And then I think this record is kind of a testament to a drum machine not sounding like a drum machine. I would blend it. I did more blending on this record than mixing, which is something modern records really don't have much of, where I like the sound of 60s recordings and 50s recordings because there's a mystery. You really don't exactly know how many instruments are on a record. You can't really count them because they're kind of blending into each other. Sometimes there could be more than one bass on it, acoustic and electric, but you really don't know. And with this stuff, I tried to, with reverb and EQs, blend things so well that you don't even think about how many instruments or whether it's real drums or drum machine.
So you start with the drums and then what?
And then I would lay down probably the main guitar part and then follow that with a bass line and then the rest is just craziness.
A lot of people might be wondering, why bother to make cover recordings? The originals exist. Why do them over again?
Well, I did it. I started doing this at a time when I was becoming disgusted with the music business. I was putting one album out a year and going on tour for about 3 or 4 months to promote it. And then I'd come back, cut another record, go out. And I was kind of in this cycle that I didn't see myself getting out of. And it was all, there's always somebody waiting for the next record, and there was always people ready to comment on it. And I wanted to really get back and remember what it was I liked about music. I wanted to make sure I never forgot what I liked about music. So I would pick a song and just go down in the basement and cut a version of it in about 1 hour's time, all basically first takes. I would mix it and put it in a can and just it was a hobby, just for the sake of music.
So all these were recorded in your home basement studio?
Mm-hmm. And the reason I would do covers to relax is because I didn't feel like I had to convey the song as strongly as I would if I had written it. Because when you write your own songs, you're still wondering if the song could be better because you wrote it and you have control over it. These songs are already written. They're already there, and I already liked them for what they were, so there's no pressure for you know, to convey the song as strongly as it would if, you know, if I had written it.
When you say that you made these so that you never forgot what it is that you loved about music, you mean like the immediacy and no fancy production work, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, and just a good song. A good song is a good song, you know. And also, I really wanted to prove to myself that I could work in mono and get depth and color and as much feeling. See, I started out in the music business when 24-track multi-track recording was already state of the art. It was already the way everybody did it. And whenever I would try to do anything in mono or on less than 24 tracks, people would slap my hand and tell me I was out of my mind and that I was very unprofessional. I didn't know what was going on. I was never going to make it in the music business, you know. And I wanted to prove that you can make a great record with an 8-track machine, which actually only 7 tracks on this machine really work. One of them hasn't been working for years. And mix it in mono and have it still hold up next to the records that are out there now.
What do you like about mono?
Well, I like the fact that it's a finished mix no matter where a person is standing in their house. You know, I go to some people's houses and they have one speaker in the kitchen and one in the living room. And if they're listening to a very stereo record, they're only getting half of the picture. And also, of course, the tradition of Brian Wilson and Phil Spector making such great records in mono has always been an inspiration.
My guest is songwriter, musician, and record producer Ben Vaughan. His new album, Mono USA, features his cover recordings of old obscure pop tunes. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Musician, songwriter, and record producer Ben Vaughan is with us. His new album is called Mono USA. Let's move on to another record that you cover on your new album, Mono. And this is a song called Sundown, Sundown, performed by Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazelwood. The obvious question, Nancy Sinatra.
That's a question? I'm a big Nancy fan. These Boots Are Made for Walking was one of my favorite records as a kid, and Lee Hazelwood was a great songwriter and producer. He produced all the Duane Eddy records.
Did he?
Yes, he did. Yeah, in Phoenix, Arizona. And then he came out to Los Angeles and he did, he also did Dino, Desi, and Billy. So he had like a reputation for doing the children of the stars, you know. But he was a great writer and I like his voice too. It's very deep. I can almost sing like him. And in this song, actually, I dropped the key a step to make it even lower for my voice.
So was this recorded post These Boots Are Made for Walking?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to tell us how your version compares to the original?
I think mine is more bombastic. It's it's noisier, it's brighter, and the tempo is probably up a little bit on it. I also did not have the luxury of being able to contract a string section.
Right.
So I had to make up for it in other ways.
Like how?
Vibrato guitar, mainly, and some organ.
You know what I'd like to do, Ben? I'd like to play your version first of Sundown, Sundown, and then we'll go to the original that you covered as performed by Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazelwood.
Okay.
Never going to be. There's no one in this world needs me. There's never going to be. And yet sometimes in my dreams I hear. There's never gonna be. And yet sometimes in my dreams I hear.
Sundown, I miss.
Ben, I think you did good not being able to afford those strings.
Yeah, I think so too. I think what I didn't like about that original version, I really like the song. I think it's a really moody, weird song. You know, you're not exactly sure what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And the duet idea really works as far as her voice coming in as almost like his dream or an angel or something. And I thought it could have been moodier. And the original arrangement had kind of a typical Hollywood kind of string arrangement on it and horns that I thought it would sound creepier and stranger if I took it down to a vibrato guitar, an organ, and a lot of reverb.
Yeah, I like your vocal on it very much, too.
Oh, thanks.
Who's singing with you?
That's Jezebel from the Friggs. They're a band that I've been producing.
Now, there's another record I want to compare, your version and the original. And I asked you to bring the original of the Billy Joe Royal record that you do here, Dark Glasses, because I really like the arrangement on your version of it. I've never heard the original. And I think in a lot of ways your new record is about arrangements. And I think one of the differences between pop and rock is the emphasis on arrangements.
That's entirely true. You listen to a Coasters song or you listen to something by Gene Pitney or Billy Joe Royal, for example. He was produced by Joe South, and Joe South was a great producer and arranger, but it took him a while to get really good. With Down in the Boondocks was the beginning of it being perfect. And this is early Billy Joe Royal from 1963, where he's trying to sound like Gene Pitney or Clyde McFadder, and Joe South is doing a bass vocal part that makes the song a funny song. Now, when I heard it as not being really a funny song. I thought with a darker arrangement and a more musical arrangement that it could be a serious song.
Why don't we hear the Billy Joe Royal version and your version back to back?
Everything was still all right. Well, I just had to hide all those teardrops that I cried. I wore dark glasses last night. Yes, the life of the party.
I'm not saying this because you're sitting across the table from me, but I really like your version better.
Oh, well, thanks. I like them both. I have to say that I wouldn't have recorded this song if I wasn't in love with the original record. But I just heard a different arrangement, you know, in my head, and I wanted to mess with it and see if maybe the storyline of the song could be told better in a different arrangement. But I like them both a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. I think your new album, Mono, shows off your work as a producer as well as a musician. You've produced other people's records as well. Who are some of the producers, and what are some of the production styles that have influenced you as a producer?
Well, I really like Phil Spector a lot, but that's on a large level of production. That's something that really you couldn't even do anymore anyway, because it's just a different time, different machinery in studios, different tastes in the public. But I really love his production. You've Lost That Loving Feeling, I think, is a masterpiece of a record. I really like Brian Wilson a lot. I also like, Joe South I really like. Games People Play, Down in the Boondocks. The sound he got on those records were really great. I like Lee Hazelwood. Sonny Bono did a great job with the Sonny and Cher stuff. There's probably a million producers. Terry Melcher, who produced The Byrds and Paul Revere and the Raiders, is one of my personal favorites. He was really able to do the ultimate transistor radio mix. That stuff was in mono, and it just sounded so compressed and so great on a radio back then when it came out. And also Dave Clark 5 records, too. They were just explosions of, it was like cannon fire or something when his drums would hit.
Your album Mono came out in parts of Europe before it was released in the States. I think you're becoming very well known in Europe. What kind of following do you have there?
I have a very strange following in Europe. I go over there a lot now. I'm very popular there, and I'm going back for a tour now that's being booked that may never end. I may never come back. I'm not sure. It keeps getting extended into different countries, but Mono came out there in Italy and also in France and became a very popular record. And the fans there are just fans of American music, and for them, I'm kind of the perfect guy right now because I wear it on my sleeve. These are all American songs, by the way, that I covered on this, all American artists.
One last question on your new Mono record, your record of cover recordings. There's a song on here that I do know. It's the only song I know this whole record. And I'll confess, it's a song I hate.
Really?
Yeah. It's Skip a Rope, the Henson Cargill 1968 hit. This is the only record on the album that actually made it, I think, into the top 40. To me, it's an example of what like bad pop did to the bad message song.
Well, see, I have a soft spot in my heart for message tunes that came out of Nashville because it was a weird place, like Mr. Businessman by Ray Stevens.
Right.
You know, Air Conditioned Sinuses. There's actually a line in there about air conditioned sinuses, and I love that because it's Nashville trying to be relevant, and Skip a Rope is a great example of that. But the real reason I cut that was, two reasons. One, I used to have a job in a factory where they played country radio all day long, and this would have been in about 73. And for some reason, Skip a Rope, which is already 5 years old as a record, they would play it about 20 times a day on this radio station. And I, for the longest time, thought he was singing Skid Row.
Oh, yeah.
So I had this kind of weird infatuation with this song, and I finally heard the song and found out what the lyrics were about and everything. Yeah, it's kind of hokey, but I really like the line in there, stab him in the back, that's the name of the game.
Yeah, really. It's one of these really shallow songs about hypocrisy.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
Well, it's been great fun having you here. I love the album. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, it was great.
I'll listen to the children while they play. Ooh, ain't it kind of funny what the children say? Skip a rope. Stab them in the back, that's the name of the game. And mommy and daddy are who's to blame? Skip a rope. Skip a rope.
Ben Vaughan's new album, Mono USA, is on Bar None Records. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on All Things Considered on the president's trip overseas?
Hi, Terry. Sylvia Pagioli reports on the agreement reached with Ukraine. Ukraine will do away with its nuclear weapons. Mostly it was a financial arrangement. Also, Mara Liasson reports on the president's views on Bosnia, restating the willingness of the United States in accord with allies to consider airstrikes against Serb gun positions to break the siege of Sarajevo. Wade Goodwin reports in other news from Texas tonight on the opening of the Branch Davidian trial. And I'll talk with a survivor of a 1944 explosion at a Navy ammunition center. 50 Navy seamen, all African Americans, were charged with mutiny after that for refusing to go back to work.
Thanks, Noah. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tomorrow night on the Fox network, Henry Winkler, who played the Fonz on Happy Days, returns to TV with a new sitcom called Monty. Winkler stars as Monty Richardson, a conservative TV talk show host. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The Fonz is a pompous Republican media star? What a rush. The idea behind Monty is to take one part Rush Limbaugh and one part All in the Family. Like Tim Allen's character in Home Improvement, Henry Winkler's Monty Richardson stars on TV, then comes home and gets into trouble. He's supposed to be like Archie Bunker with a larger vocabulary and a bigger outlet for his rantings and ravings. Now, as sitcom concepts go, that's not too bad. But a lot can go wrong between concept and execution. As it turns out, the best thing about the pilot is the opening credits, in which people are asked their opinion of the fictional TV talk show star.
What do you think of Monty?
What do I think about him?
I think he's a nut.
I think he's absolutely gorgeous.
Not handsome, but he has a little charisma.
I think he looks disgusting.
What do I think of Monty? I think that Henry Winkler, who is executive producer of this series, has let himself down. As the star, Winkler could handle the comedy, although I'd rather have seen the role go to, Brian Dennehy or Dave Thomas. But as the executive producer, he's accepted a pilot script that's so lame, I can't imagine people giving it a second chance. Winkler is lucky the series is on Fox because the studio audiences there will laugh at anything, even the pathetic punchlines that are tossed out during Monty's TV show within this TV show.
Question two. God is A, a religious being worshipped by most people. B, what dyslexics call a dog. Or C, some supreme being that commands you to rent a truck, fill it with dynamite, drive over potholes all over New York City, blow up a building, and then try to get your deposit back.
Viewers at home, though, won't find anything to laugh about. The only reason to watch the pilot of Monty is to check out the truly eclectic cast. Monty's wife is played by Kate Burton, daughter of Richard. Monty's elder son, Greg, is played by David Schwimmer, who recently appeared on NYPD Blue as the paranoid apartment dweller known as 4B. Not only is he a bit too old for the role, then again, so was Winkler when he played Fonzie, but it's a big step down career-wise from NYPD Blue to Monty. And Greg's new girlfriend, Gina, whom he brings back with him from Europe, is played by Chyna Kantner. If that name's not familiar, she's the daughter of two former members of the Jefferson Airplane, Paul Kantner and Grace Slick. I know. I hardly believe it myself. But hey, two of Frank Zappa's kids co-starred on a sitcom a few years ago, so why not? But none of this comes together. The way Monty is written, Greg and Gina obviously are meant to be the meathead and Gloria to Monty's Archie. But dinner time at the Richardson household is a lot less entertaining than it was at the Bunkers.
Okay, Dad. This has to be eaten at just the right temperature to get the essence of the basil oregano sauce.
What the hell happened to you in Europe? Oregano, basil, Gina? Well, I like the basil and oregano.
If you want to laugh at a funny TV conservative, stick with the original article and watch Rush Limbaugh. At least there, you don't have to watch him eat.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Harry Wu. He spent 19 years in China's prison labor camps after he was denounced as a stinking intellectual and a bourgeois. He's now a resident scholar at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. In 1991, he returned to China to document human rights abuses in its prisons. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.